Well, good morning to the hordes of people that are here. I wanted to talk about self-esteem this morning. I've got a few notes, and lots of things were suddenly coming to me as we were doing the service. When we were reading one of the texts this morning, I thought, oh yes, that fits, and that fits, and that fits, and that fits. Whether any of those will make it into what I say this morning, or whether they'll just leak out, whether they've already leaked out in the past few minutes, I don't know, we'll wait, we'll see. So I guess I'll start by saying something about what I think healthy self-confidence is and unhealthy self-confidence. Unhealthy, that's not quite the right word, but that, like, and what the shadow of self-confidence is. And the same with humility and low self-esteem. The first Buddhist teacher that I ever met in person, this must have been a question that I had about self-confidence. It was a sort of koan that was around for me at the time when I met him. I remember seeing something on television. Gosh, it was actually Nip Tuck. Does anyone remember? It was a drama about two plastic surgeons in Hollywood. And I saw a couple of episodes. And there were these two, the two main characters were quite different from each other, almost like archetypes, really. One of them was a sort of alpha male, ultra confident, fast cars, lots of beautiful girlfriends, making lots of money, interested in kind of feeding those desires. And there was something very charismatic and slightly attractive about him. His confidence I found really compelling, even though I could see that morally he was completely flawed. You know, people were getting hurt left, right and centre. But in the middle of this was this kind of majestic grand male, like a sort of lion on the prairie, just saying, well, here I am, you know. And then the other character was full of self-doubt, questioning the morals of the whole enterprise. His marriage was falling apart. He sort of epitomised low self-esteem, really. But at the same time, going alongside that, there was a moral strand to his thinking, even though he couldn't quite pull it off because he hadn't got the courage to do it. And at that time in my life, I was sort of deciding what I wanted to do. And I thought, well, there's something very attractive about the man with lots of money and a really nice car. This kind of big male character who's strutting through the jungle. But I can also see there's a real shadow. There's also something really distasteful about it. On the other hand, this other guy, I like that. I like the moral questioning. I like the fact that he's interested in what the right thing to do is. But I don't like the fact that he hasn't got the confidence to do it. So I went and asked the Buddhist teacher, who was part of a Tibetan school, and I wasn't practicing Tibetan Buddhism, just happened to be the closest place to where I was living at the time. And I said, how does self-confidence fit into Buddhism? You know, it's not really talked about much. And he said, I think maybe he'd been talking quite a lot about humility. And I asked about self-confidence. And he said to me, self-confidence, genuine self-confidence and humility are the same. And I thought, oh, okay, I really like that. Because both of them come from a realistic appraisal of how you are in any given situation. If you're put in a situation where you don't know what you're doing, you have genuine humility about it. And that's true of all situations to some degree. You know, if someone says, can you come over and fix my plumbing, and you don't know a wrench from an elbow joint, well, I don't know. Then hopefully you don't go, oh yes, I'll do it, and then suddenly there's water everywhere. Actually, the sort of the realistic and appropriate response is to say, I don't know what I'm doing, you need to call a plumber. But if you're a qualified plumber and you really do know, or even not qualified, if you really do know what you're doing and you've been doing it for years, it would be inappropriate to say, actually, I don't know what I'm doing, I can't do this. So genuine self-confidence and humility come from a clear seeing of what is real, particularly your situation in the midst of whatever you're facing. So ego, if we call this sort of the overinflated position egotism and the underinflated position low self-esteem, then from a Buddhist point of view, they're equally both distortions of what is real. One is a distortion that talks about you being able to do more than you can in an unrealistic way, and one is a distortion that talks about you being able to do less than you can, an overvaluing and an undervaluing. And the position of self-confidence and humility is somewhere in the middle. And the egotistical position can be very attractive because it does go along with a lot of confidence. And in the short term, particularly, that's very attractive because I guess biologically we're programmed to be interested in where the power is, because if we can get close to the power, then we're safer in the tribe, all those sorts of things going on. But if you look at egotism in the long term, it causes problems. Because any view of the world that is a distortion of reality will cause problems in the long term. Essentially, because if you're egotistical, you will think that you can do more than that you can, or that you deserve more than you can, and the world will come along and thwart you very regularly. If you're very egotistical, of course, you won't let that, but you won't see that. You blame other people, or you blame other things. You don't take any responsibility for it, which allows you to go on keeping that side of your character alive. And all the while, you're suffering on another level. Your suffering is getting worse and worse and worse, because what you really want, you're not getting. You're standing in your own way of getting it. Because eventually people twig that you don't know what you're doing, and so on, and things start to fall apart. The same is true of the opposite position. If you continually undervalue yourself, people get fed up of that. Or the world continually gives you opportunities to show that you can succeed. Or even you do succeed sometimes, and you blame that on others, or you say it was just a fluke. And you continually miss out on all of the things that you're looking for to keep that story alive. A little bit later, I'll look at where those stories come from and what we can do, different ways of working with them. But I just wanted to come back to the idea of sort of healthy self-confidence for a moment. Although in English we say self-confidence, the Buddhist idea of self-confidence is not selfish at all in the technical sense. If you think about what self-confidence is, it's quite hard to define in positive, well, you can define it in positive terms, but it's almost easier to define it as an absence of maybe particular kinds of anxiety. Or in the sense of the egotistical position, an absence of overvaluing and overinflating. So self-confidence isn't selfish, because actually you're not interested in your own genuine, the kind of most ideal form of self-confidence from a Buddhist point of view. You're not interested in how you appear to other people. What you're interested in is, what's an effective use of my energy in this situation? How can I respond best to the situation that's in front of me? It's a lack of self-confidence is a lack of self-consciousness. When you're completely absorbed in the activity that you're doing. Or maybe you are self-conscious, but it doesn't produce the kind of anxiety reactions that we often think about when we think about self-consciousness. So you maybe notice how you are in the situation, but you don't, that doesn't become a barrier for you behaving effectively in the situation. So if it's not self-confidence, we can just say that it's confidence. The Buddhist position is that self-confidence is just confidence, not only in yourself to an appropriate level, you know, that realistically reflects what you can actually do in the situation, but really confidence in reality itself, confidence that it's better to see what is really in front of you than run from it. It's better to behave in a way that's compassionate than in a way that's selfish. All those sorts of things. Confidence, as Iris Murdoch said, that it's good to be good for its own sake. So one of the things that makes a difference between someone who's confident and somebody who isn't confident in that model is trust or faith. And you don't necessarily, you don't start out with that if you're in one of the other positions. If you're undervaluing yourself or overvaluing yourself, one way of understanding that is that it's a lack of trust in the kind of things that I talked about.
Isn't it a lack of trust in self? It's to do with self-awareness as well, isn't it? And your own boundaries and limitations and having to know those.
Well, I will address that. I'll probably take more questions at the end, but as you've raised that, no is the simple answer. It's confidence in self that's realistic rather than over or under inflated, as I said before. So you can include an awareness of yourself, but it's not, the shadow, there's always a shadow to every spiritual teaching. The shadow of focusing your energy on yourself is that if you're coming from a position, and I mean, I'll talk about this as a practice anyway, because I think it is quite helpful, but if you're coming from a position where you quite easily fall into overinflating or underinflating yourself, to practice by working on yourself is quite difficult because you're working in the dangerous area. It's quite easy when you look at yourself and you have a tendency to over or under inflate to go back into that without noticing. So I'm constantly coming back to saying it has to be realistic. Now you can work on that end, and that's a good thing to do, and I'll talk about some practices about that in a minute. But the other end you can work on is seeing what is in front of you in a realistic way, because it's likely to be less defended than your own view of yourself, which is the thing that we cling on to the most. So that's why it's very difficult. Okay, so we seem to be talking about practices that help. Now, I was talking about trust and confidence. And I guess, Miriam, what you raised, you could talk about as the kind of the sort of traditional mindfulness practices where you notice yourself in the situation. So, well, let's think a little bit more about the problem before we think about the solution. Those two different kinds of self positions, underinflating or overinflating the ego, have the same kind of root, actually. They're usually defending us against something that we feel we're unable to cope with. And it might be that for whatever reason, if we were to see ourselves clearly in the mirror, Alongside that would come a whole host of emotional reactions, which feel overwhelming. And when we get close to that, we slide back into overinflating or into underinflating. Because even though in the long term we know they cause problems, in the short term they protect us from really seeing ourselves as we are and whatever feelings come alongside that. Why might there be overwhelming feelings that come alongside seeing yourself as you really are? Because actually seeing yourself as you really are is a good thing to do. Well, because unfortunately we learn from society, from our families, from past lives. We've had an experience at some point of how we are not being acceptable, pushing somebody else's buttons, or we do something unskillful and it produces a bigger reaction in somebody else. And every time that happens, we close down slightly. And actually, every time that happens, we've got an opportunity to react compassionately. But often when it happens when we're very young, we haven't developed the sort of bigness of mind to be able to do that. So instead of being able to feel the response to... If you're very young and you reach out to somebody and you get rejected, the idea is for you to be able to feel that rejection in a very kind of spacious way and go, okay, so I've been rejected, that's okay, that's part of what happens, and I move on and feel all the feelings that come up with it. But that's only going to be possible if you feel that it's safe to do that. It might be that feeling rejected feels like a survival issue because there's nowhere else that feels safe, or you haven't got an experience of being able to lean into anything else that feels safe. So when you reach out and it's rejected, or it's not accepted in the manner that you would find acceptable, you don't feel the response to it, you shut down, and you find a way of negotiating the situation that allows you to stay safe. Either you change who you are, you mask your feelings, you change who you are so that the other person finds you acceptable, or there's all sorts of different things that can happen in that scenario that lead to particular kinds of protectiveness, so that you don't have to deal with the fact that you've been disappointed, essentially, that you've tried to reach out to somebody and you've been disappointed, or that you've expected somebody to reach out to you and you've been disappointed. Sometimes we don't know that we can handle that, so we produce a personality that can handle it in the short term, but it usually misses out those bits of reality that feel overwhelming. And two of the typical stories that come out of that experience are that we underinflate our ego. Oh, I feel worthless. And maybe then you get some sympathy, or at least you don't have to try reach. It keeps you from reaching out again. If you've got a story that's underinflating you, you no longer have to test reality to find out. So you don't get disappointed again. You never get to find out whether anything else in the universe would accept you reaching out, or whether anything else is going to love you, because you've been so wounded by the first experience that you shut down. That part of you shuts down and you don't want to risk the experience of being rejected again. So you undervalue. Or alternatively, you put up strong arm and you say, well, I don't need that person's reaction anyway. And you sort of feed yourself internally and you produce this really strong image that actually rests on very shaky foundations. And you do that in the same way. It protects you from really connecting with the other in a genuine way. So again, you don't really test out whether people genuinely are able to accept your reaching out or reach out to you. You just tell yourself that everybody loves you. regardless of what the reality is. And that's another way of protecting yourself from the same kind of wounding again. So although we might look at people in the world and think, oh, they're very self-confident, and they're got very low self-esteem, if the self-confident person is sort of egotistical and overinflated, then actually they're probably more similar to the person with low self-esteem than you might think. And a friend of mine, who's a bereavement counsellor, was saying to me recently that he notices people who come in and are egotistical in some way, they overinflate themselves, tend to flip into underinflating themselves. So you often get both of those two things in one person, actually. Although you might more usually present as one or more usually present as the other, they're probably both present, because what happens is, as you get close to the clear seeing of reality, that becomes too much. You either flip back into your habitual position, but if that's been challenged because you're in a counselling session and you're slowly starting to deconstruct the overinflatedness, then you go into the other position that can protect you equally from the rewounding, which is the underinflated position. So there's this kind of flip-flopping between the two of them, which is a protective cycle. And what we don't know, or what we think we don't know, is that one is that wounding is survivable, and two is that we can, as we grow and develop spiritually, we can respond to that wounding and future woundings ourselves with love and compassion. Not only that there are other things, other people, sanghas, communities, and Buddhas in the universe that will respond to those wounds with love and compassion, and will respond to who we are genuinely with love and compassion. But when we're in those stories, we don't want to test it out because of the first experience was too overwhelming. And that comes from the fact that as ordinary human beings, we're brought up in societies where we're surrounded by ordinary human beings who are also having these kinds of experiences. So that's what we lean into and trust. And some people are more or less flawed than other people in those kinds of ways. When the only thing that you can lean into is going to reject you or wound you in that particular way. And if it's another human being, that's probably inevitable at some point. Then you're going to become slightly defensive. You're going to become slightly protective and begin to move into one of these positions. So being able to experience leaning into something that isn't defensive in the same way is actually a really powerful antidote to this. And it might be that that's going to a counsellor who can hold it together for 50 minutes and be the best person they can for that time that you're seeing them. Or it might be that you go to a spiritual community that, even though they're made up of ordinary human beings, that they're attempting to exemplify something, and they're able at least to talk about wounding and bring things into the open, which actually allows when things are exposed that they become much less powerful, and you're able to experience your own vulnerabilities in those sorts of communities in ways that are much more difficult when you're in a community of people who are over or under inflating because they're all scared. And beyond that, of course, is something like the Buddha, which is around in the universe, or the idea of Buddha-ness in the universe, Tathagata, or the Dharmakaya, the kind of the Tao that has no name, if you like, or as Dhammavijja says, but we give it many different names in Buddhism. Something that you can lean into that will accept you just as you are, and maybe you get a glimpse of experiencing or of sensing on a felt level that actually, even without all of this protection, the overinflation or the underinflation, I'm okay. And maybe if you don't get for that for yourself in an experience of meditation, you come here and listen to me and I say, well, that is definitely true. And you go, well, okay, maybe I'll just try trusting that and see what happens. Maybe you get an experience or maybe you don't. But if you start even just to experiment with trusting that there are things that you can lean into which won't respond in the way that scared people respond, you start to discover that it's true, because it is true. But you don't get to find that out until you test it out. So we can say, you know, there's this idea that, well, the Buddha is always there, or these things are always there in the universe. Almost like there's a hand reaching out saying, okay, well, here I am. But you have to take a little step forward and put your own hand up to find out whether the hand is going to take yours or not. And the overinflated position or the underinflated position is not putting your hand up. It's saying, in the overinflated position, it's saying, well, of course everyone takes my hand. In fact, I don't need to take anybody's hand because I'm fine just as I am. But you never get to find out what it's like to take the hand. And the underinflated position, in the same way, keeps the hands very, your own hands very tight to yourself. Oh, I can't. Oh no. Well, like, they wouldn't. If I put mine up, they wouldn't take it. And again, you don't get to find out that if you take refuge in the right thing, you get that experience. So that's, I guess, that's quite a religious way of talking about it in terms of Buddhas and so on, but. You don't need to overly think in that way, actually. All you need to do is start experimenting with not living your life from those stories, with thinking, what's the realistic appraisal of me in this situation? What can I do and what can't I do at the moment? And then acting based on that information. And what you will discover as you do that is two things. One is that you'll probably have a big emotional reaction if it's a new way of being, because all the stuff that's got locked up will start to come out. But the other is that to behave realistically is not only survivable, but will start to bring positive benefits with it. It takes quite a lot of energy to keep those stories alive and to hold reality at bay, because reality is always presenting itself over and over and over again. If you start to let go of some of those stories and allow more of reality in, it actually frees up a lot of the energy that you were using before to keep your dysfunction in place, and to keep my dysfunction in place. There isn't, if you'd search for self-confidence in the traditional Buddhist text, you won't find it, because it wasn't a virtue that was talked about. But I wanted to briefly refer to the six paramitas, because that's a description of how a bodhisattva or a Buddhist saint is in the world. And I thought, well, actually, that's a pretty good description of how somebody who is behaving realistically in the Buddhist sense of the word would be in the world. So it describes six qualities that a person has. Generosity of spirit and material generosity, because you don't need to hoard things, because you're not afraid in the way that you were afraid if you're inhabiting one of those stories. Sila paramita means virtue, but really it's a sort of naturally behaving in good ways. Again, because when you don't have to protect yourself in the ways that these ways protect yourself, you can just respond to things as they arise in the moment in a good way. Then there's patience, and again, exactly the same formula. If you're not worried about whether you're overvalued or undervalued, if you don't need to keep those stories alive, then actually you can wait for things to unfold in their own time. Another of them might be concentration, so that when somebody comes in, you can they're welcome, have a seat.
Can you get it back to patience?
Yeah, I mean, these are six virtues, or the six parameters that somebody who's self-confident in the Buddhist sense would have. Patience. is one of them, is the third one. And really, patience just means, well, it's a particular, it means not needing to change reality from what it is at a pace that it doesn't want to go at. So it's about going at the pace of things naturally unfolding rather than pushing them because you're scared of particular outcomes. If you're not worried about, in this case, how you appear in any situation, then you don't need to rush into something to make it the right way that suits you. You just say, okay, I can just take a breath and be with this situation and see what the best action to take is. What is it ready for this kind of, is it ready for me to step in and do something here, or do the conditions need to change slightly? If you're rushing in, you're probably rushing in because you want to be seen in a particular way, either in a way that you're rushing in to change things and make things good so that everybody sees you with your overinflated ego as being the one who saves everything, or you're maybe rushing in the other direction because you don't want to be seen as the person who can have a good response to it. So patience is just that moment of taking a breath before either of those responses kick in, or any other responses that are about protecting your identity.
And that's so, the spaciousness. That
yes, exactly. About. That's the spaciousness, yeah. But the one that I really liked, which I mentioned before doing this list, is virya, which is translated as energy, diligence, vigilance, effort. I thought, well, actually, what if you look at somebody who's self-confident, one of the things that's most attractive about them is that they've got a lot of energy. They can put sustained energy into things appropriately. And as I said earlier, if you're not putting energy into protecting your self-image, if you don't need to cultivate an image that's more than you really are, or cultivate an image that's less than you really are, that frees up a lot of energy. So you can just do what needs to be done. And ordinary people will move in and out of these qualities, actually. You may have you may discover that you've got energy for a particular project, and then something happens that pushes the button, and instantly you think, oh, I need to present myself in this way in order to protect myself from whatever it is that's about to happen. So you lose the energy, you step away from the project, or you put the energy into creating a particular image of yourself, cultivating a particular idea of who you are. That's not really about what needs to be done at all. The others are concentration. The other qualities are concentration or meditation. Jhana really is about the kind of mind that sees things as they really are. So that's just a name for what the sort of thing that I've been talking about all along. And I suppose wisdom is, perhaps comes back to your question about self-awareness. It's not just an appraisal of what is happening in front of you, but it's a seeing beneath the surface of what is happening in yourself as well. So a bodhisattva is somebody who can do all of that. And what gets in the way of us doing all of that are those, well, there's lots of different stories, I suppose, but particularly the ones we're interested in this morning is the one that overinflate or underinflate our sense of self. So if you're going to practice wisdom, seeing beneath the surface is the literal translation of the word prajna. You need to start seeing beneath your own surface and saying, okay, what's my tendency? When I go into the world, do I talk about myself in ways that make me out to be better than I am, or do I talk about myself in ways that make me out to be worse than I am, or are there particular situations where I do one of those and other situations where I do the other of those? And if I am doing that, what am I protecting myself from in that moment? Is it just that I can't bear the idea that I don't know what I'm doing So in my own case, when I was young, a lot of where I got value from was in being quite bright and intelligent as a child, and people liked that, so I received praise for it. I took to things quickly. But as I became older and things became more difficult, they became extra difficult for me, because what I learned to value, instead of myself as I really was the idea that I had to be quick, bright, intelligent, take things easy in order to receive praise, value, love, in order to be acceptable. So rather than being, when things became difficult, rather than just being able to deal with them or to go and ask for help and say, actually, I've been looking at this maths textbook for an hour and I don't even know what the words say on it because I just can't process it. Somebody come up past and go, oh yes, I know what I'm doing, don't worry. Because I need to protect myself. And the fear is that if I ask for help, I won't get the kind of praise that I got before, which was where I felt nurtured. And even now, as an adult, I can see sometimes in groups that I fall back into that way of being, or I make the quick comment, the intelligent comment, because in that way people will like me. And even I'm the one in this group who's sitting here giving the talk, for example. So I get a particular kind of value from that.
Namaste.
Well, I'm aware of that working, which I think gives me a little bit of... I don't know. I'm just trying to big myself up again. There'll be other patterns like that at work in my own life that I don't know about, but that's one that I've noticed. And when that comes up in other situations, if I notice it, I can say, oh, maybe I can be a bit different in this group today. Or maybe I can say, this is something that I'm struggling with. Or let somebody else be the one who gets the praise for being intelligent and bright and see what happens. And as I test that out, what I discover is that in the groups of people that I move in now and in my Sangha, actually, I'm just as acceptable, whether I'm the smartest one in the room, in my opinion, or not. I mean, obviously it's true that I am. That's the kind of seeing beneath the surface that's really important. And not just in your own case, but as you start to live and work with others, you get to know their patterns a little bit as well. And even if you don't get to know their patterns, you can assume that when they are rejecting you, when they're being dysfunctional, when they're overinflating themselves or underinflating themselves, when they're not in that balanced place of self-confidence, the patterns that they're displaying come from equally, you know, come from their own causes and conditions in their own lives. So maybe you can feel a bit softer towards the people that you're interacting with, which gives them a different experience of being with somebody who isn't scared. So they get to try out how it is to be a bit looser with those patterns. You get to experience how it is to be with somebody who's being a bit looser with those patterns, which can only be a good thing in the long run. In the short term, it might mean that there's a bit of kind of frizz on as you both adjust and feel some of those things that you hadn't felt before. Okay, so maybe I'll just sum up some of the things that I've talked about. So I started by describing self-confidence and humility as the same thing in Buddhist terms. They're both a genuine appraisal of yourself in the circumstance. And that means having the self-confidence to know when you can do something well, but also the humility to know where your learning edges are and to be able to treat them both the same. And that's about, we talked a little bit about where those underinflation and overinflation stories come from and how you can flip between both of them even in the same person. I guess what we've just been talking about is connects back with what I said earlier about trusting, that actually you need a little bit of trust or confidence that there is a way of being that is better than being egotistical or having low self-esteem, and that will ultimately be not more nourishing for you and for other people. You need a little bit of confidence in that, just a smidgen, in order to start to test it out. And as you test it out and you start to experience the fruits of it, becomes a positive feedback cycle. That doesn't mean that it's easy to do. You also get all the sort of emotional reactions that go alongside of it as well. But when you start to notice that, oh, well, I did ask for help then and I received it. Or actually, when I did that thing that I knew I could do, but I sort of talked about it in a way that made it out that I couldn't do it. Oh, well, now it's done. Not only is it done, but people appreciate it being done. And then maybe you do it again next time. So that middle position of genuine self-confidence is about, it's about a realistic appraisal of yourself in the world, but it's also about trusting that there is a deep value in seeing yourself clearly and in seeing others clearly, and that it's from that clear seeing that compassion and fellow feeling and all of the things that give us meaning and warmth and encourage love to flow between us come from that clear seeing. Not only the clear seeing, but also taking action as a result of the clear seeing. And in fact, the Buddha once said that enlightenment, which I suppose is what we're talking about under another name, is like a bird with two wings. One of those wings is wisdom, which is the clear seeing and the kind of working out how these stories work in your own lives and in other people's lives. And the other wing is compassion. And he said, if you only have one of those qualities, then you should have compassion, because it's no good sitting on your cushion going, well, I know what's going on for me, I know what's going on for all those other people, but I'm just going to sit here and not do anything about it. You need to respond appropriately as well. You need to take compassionate action in order to progress along the path. If you are compassionate and you only see a little bit of the picture clearly, or none of the picture clearly, actually, being compassionate, even if you do it in a way that's unskillful, two things happen. First of all, the spirit of your action stays in you and hopefully is received by the world and stays in the world, even if it results in things being more chaotic than you'd intended. But the second is, you can learn wisdom from being compassionate, because you find out what happens when you take the act, and that gives you more information. And if you see that information clearly, then you develop more wisdom. So although this morning I've talked a lot about the sort of inner qualities, seeing the stories, learning to trust and so on, they only start to make a difference in your own life if you then start to behave differently in the world, saying, I can do this, so I'm going to do it and find out what happens. Well, I don't know what I'm doing so much in this area, so I'm going to get some help. And then going and getting some help. It's no good just sitting and saying, well, yes, I know that I can do this and I can't do that, but actually, unless that becomes manifest in your life, it's not really going to change you on a deep level. We often think that we're led by our inner world to take action in the world, or we're conditioned by the feelings that we have. The actions that we take are conditioned by the feelings that we have. That's true, but it's perhaps not so helpful, because it's actually quite difficult to change the feelings that we have. It's also true that your feelings and your inner world are heavily conditioned by the actions that you take in the world. Well, it's easier to control your actions, so that's maybe a more useful piece of advice. If you want to feel differently, act differently. Namo Amitabha.